Why, oh, why, oh, why.
Oh, I hit it.
Maria, oh, why, oh, why, oh, Maria, oh, why, oh, yeah. Maria, oh, why, oh, why, oh, Maria, oh, why, oh.
Network, this is the news. This is the network. This is the news. This is the network. Network in sports.
I'm Tom Rowe in Accra, and you have tuned into the WGXC Morning Show. Today on the WGXC Morning Show, Roger Hannigan Gilson from the Times Union will talk about the stories he's been working on lately and is about to. Stories in your community in the Hudson Valley. We'll also hear Philip Grant with the local news. We'll hear the Public News Service with national headlines. And the Catskill Makers Syndicate has the better weather. Coming up on the WGXC Morning Show, live today from Hudson, you're listening to Creative Community Solar-Powered Radio, WGXC 90.7 FM. Stay tuned for all the local news and more. Start your day on WGXC.
This is the news. This is the network. This is the news. This is the network. Network. This is the news. This is the network. This is the news. This is the network. Network. And the moon turns the blood. A stream runs through. And the moon turns the blood. This is the network. Network. And the moon turns the blood. A stream runs through. And the moon turns the blood. This is the network. Network. This is the news. This is the network. This is the news. This is the network.
This is Viafranca Ture, and you're listening to WGXC Accra 90.7 FM.
WGXC underwriting support is provided in part by Sun Common, supporting vibrant communities across New York for 15 years, offering custom solar installations for homes, farms, and businesses. Information at suncommon.com.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Stuart Summer of Hillsdale, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. Become a WGXC sustaining supporter today. Go to WGXC.org and click donate. Thank you for your support.
From the WGXC newsroom, this is the WGXC News Update. Mike Goodwin and H. Rose Snyder report in the Times Union that normal Amtrak service will be returned on November 17th and partial service will be back on November 16th. Structural issues in a building near the tracks in New York City have halted service since November 12th. On November 14th, Governor Kathy Hochul said, and I quote, "While we know it can be difficult to repair aging infrastructure, a delay of this length is unacceptable," end quote. Travelers have been able to take Amtrak trains to the Croton Harmon station and then transfer to Metro North trains to get into New York City. During the disruption, Amtrak allowed customers on trains with similar departure times or on another day and waived additional charges for customers changing their reservations. Read more about this story in the Times Union. Patricia Ardoxy reports for the Daily Freeman that Republican Michael Kavanaugh has conceded to Democrat Emmanuel Nenji in the election for Ulster County District Attorney. Kavanaugh said, and I quote, "After consulting with my team, it appears that the current vote tally provides Manny Nenji an insurmountable lead in the race for Ulster County District Attorney. Therefore, we have asked the Board of Elections to cease counting any remaining outstanding absentee ballots and declare Mr. Ninja the winner, end quote. Ninja received 58 votes on November 15th following the count of 98 absentee ballots. That put him up by 368 votes over Kavanaugh, 24,206 to 23,838. And on November 15th, 12 more absentee ballots will be counted, but that will not be enough for Kavanaugh. In the initial ballot count without absentee ballots, Ninja was winning by only 195 votes. Kavanaugh said, and I quote, "While we ultimately came up just short of our goal, I'm very proud of my team and the campaign we ran. In a county where Democrat candidates enjoy a staggering advantage, we nearly accomplished what many thought impossible," end quote. Ninja will be the first black man to hold a countywide elected office in Ulster County, and is only the second Democrat as district attorney. In 2019, Democrat David Clegg defeated Kavanaugh by just 76 votes. Read more about this story in the Daily Freeman. Roger Hannigan-Gilson reports in the Times Union that environmental groups Riverkeeper and the Mid-Atlantic chapter of the Sierra Club and others say General Electric's cleanup of PCBs in the Hudson River was not as effective as the federal government predicted when they ordered the cleanup. They called the remedial dredging of the Hudson River a failure. The story says, and I quote, "PCB levels on the Hudson River bottom are falling far more slowly than the EPA expected, and the PCB levels in the section of the upper Hudson closest to the GE plants actually rose between 2016 and 2021, end quote. Between 1947 and 1977, General Electric dumped 1.2 million pounds of carcinogenic industrial forever chemicals that do not naturally break down into the Hudson River near its facilities north of Albany. GE was forced by the federal government to dredge the river bottom north of Troy, completing the cleanup in 2015. The concentrations of PCBs in fish rose between 2020 and 2021, according to a report from the environmental groups analyzing Environmental Protection Agency data. Officials recommended eating just one fish a month from the Hudson River, and pregnant or breastfeeding women are not supposed to eat any. EPA spokesperson Larissa W. Romanowski said the agency's review will be released early next year, and I quote, "will assist EPA in further understanding how well and how quickly the fish and the river system are recovering," end quote. The State Department of Environmental Conservation said the cleanup had not been adequately completed, but lost a lawsuit against GE in 2021. Last year, GE agreed to study the lower Hudson River for PCBs. Read more about this story in the Times Union. And that wraps up the WGXC News Update. You can visit our website at WGXC.org for local weather updates, public meetings, a community calendar, or COVID-19 updates. And while you're there, please click on the donate button to become a WGXC sustaining supporter or make a one-time donation. From the WGXC Newsroom, I'm Philip Grant. Have a good day and a pleasant tomorrow.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
If you are asking whether the violence at the Capitol on January 6th was part of some operation orchestrated by FBI sources and or agents, the answer is emphatically
not. You're saying no?
No.
FBI Director Christopher Wray denied Congressman Clay Higgins' assertion that the FBI helped incite January 6th. The Freedom Caucus member claims agents were at the riot dressed as Trump supporters and arrived at the Capitol on ghost buses the night before. Though Wray has long denied the conspiracy theory, the Louisiana Republican insisted, saying, "Your day is coming, Mr. Wray." In the same hearing, Wray said the Bureau has opened a number of investigations into Hamas, saying the war is increasing the possibility of a terrorist attack here. New Hampshire is still planning the first in the nation's presidential primary, despite the Democratic National Committee's calendar changes. Daniel Scanlon, New Hampshire's Secretary of State, says using racial diversity as a reason to rearrange the primary calendar sets an ugly precedent.
At what point does a state become too old, or too wealthy, or too educated, or too religious to hold an early primary?
Meanwhile, advocates are pressing lawmakers to hold social media companies accountable for their impact on young people's mental health. The Kids Online Safety Act aims to establish social media safeguards and give families transparency and online tools. Meta whistleblower Frances Haugen says giving teens and parents more control over social media can have acute benefits.
Imagine something as simple as having the right to reset your algorithms. Right now, kids have to decide between their past, you know, all their posts, all their friends, and being stuck in rabbit holes that threaten their futures.
A new study looks at what happens to children and adolescents after they survive being shot. 1 year after surviving gun violence, they have higher rates of chronic pain and psychiatric disorders and almost 150% higher rates of serious substance abuse. With mass shootings going up every year, Kelly Drain with the Giffords Law Center says something's gotta give.
Gun violence is at this really severe crisis point, but we also are seeing more states than ever really step up and pass the kind of laws that are necessary to combat this crisis. And that's not to say that we don't need more or that we're doing enough, but I think we are definitely seeing signs of progress.
A new report from the Sentencing Project digs into the reasons for persistently higher rates of incarceration for minority men. The research says variations in those incarceration rates track the higher prevalence of police traffic stops for Black and Latino drivers. Report co-author Nazgul Ganush says racial disparities have been reduced in some places, but more work must be done in states with higher incarceration rates.
If we want to eliminate racial disparities in incarceration completely, and if we actually want to get U.S. incarceration levels to be more comparable to that of our peer countries, we also need to do something to tackle rates of serious violent crime.
I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. Closed primaries keep independents, the fastest growing block of voters, from voting in a Republican or Democratic primary. To include unaffiliated voters and to offer all voters more choice, states like Nevada and Arizona are considering fully open primaries and top five races. Open primaries generally mean that any unaffiliated voter may choose to vote in a Republican or Democratic primary, but there are variations. Maine switches in 2024 to a semi-open primary, allowing independents to vote without temporarily having to switch their affiliation. A 2020 ballot measure in Alaska switched the state to a single ballot or blanket primary for its congressional election, where all candidates are on a single ballot, the top four candidates move forward, and ranked choice voting is used to select a winner. In 2024, Nevada votes on a constitutional amendment implementing a similar top five system, and signature collection just started for two similar ballot measures in Arizona. Open primaries allow more choice for voters and can encourage candidates to be more moderate. In a state like Alaska, where 58% of voters are independent, Congresswoman Mary Pertola ran with a positive campaign appealing to all voters and ultimately prevailed over former Governor Sarah Palin. Palin ran a largely negative campaign focused on her party opponents. We have more on how open primaries work at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.
Hello and welcome to the better weather. My coffee pot has finished, so it is time to do the weather for Thursday, November 16th. Local early morning temperatures range from 26 degrees in Voorheesville to 45 to our immediate west in Roxbury. Regional average soil temperature is 44 degrees. Don't forget those sunglasses this morning, as we expect to see the sun warm things up today with a high of 58 at 2 p.m. Winds will be calm, so it's a good time for work or play for anyone needing to get outside. Overnight, temperatures fall to 36 degrees before things start getting windy and possibly wet tomorrow. We get a high of 60 at 12 p.m. as skies darken and we see some isolated raindrops start to hit by 4 p.m. Overnight, that rain hits its stride. Expect a half inch or so of rain to fall by dawn. Temperatures don't really hit their low overnight as the cold front steadily lowers that mercury. We hit 44 Saturday morning and should expect some scattered rain to be about. We see a high of 46, then rain stops after 1 p.m. Temperatures hit 32 degrees overnight. Then Sunday, temperatures level out where they should be most of next week with a high of 48. Sunset today will be at 4:21 p.m. Sunrise tomorrow will be at 6:43 a.m. Looking way up, we see plasma winds will be average at 427 kilometers per second with an average density of 7 protons per cubic centimeter. Radio propagation conditions are currently pretty bad till dark, then fair below 15 megahertz overnight. There are no chances for aurora this evening. The current sunspot number is 41, and this has been the Better Weather, brought to you by the Catskill Makers Syndicate.
And on Tom Rowe here live in Hudson today. And with me is from the Albany Times Union, Roger Hannigan Gilson, the Hudson Valley reporter. How are you doing today, Roger?
I'm doing good. How are you?
We are glad to have you back after a couple weeks off. And you've been a very busy reporter, I guess, in this week back.
Yeah. You know, you got to hit the ground running. There's been kind of a lot of significant stories. The first one has to do with Windham Mountain in the Catskills.
It's just they always hope for snow Thanksgiving weekend to have to kick off the season, and it rarely comes. Right?
Yeah, no, I was talking to their PR person, and they were, you know, I was like, I know this is weather dependent, but do you have any idea when you might open? They had the snow guns going last weekend, but they were like, you know, it's up to God, really. Yeah,
they need it to be below 32 overnight.
Yeah.
Like for the whole night, I guess, or something?
Well, for like the majority of the night, because if it just like dips below for
which is what
like
it's
an
been
hour,
doing.
You know, it's just going to like melt off, and then they're just going to have wet trails, and, you know, that doesn't help anyone out. But, you know, there's hope that, you know, the first weekend will be, you know, around December 1st. But, you know, it's up to the weather gods.
But the changes have started already.
Yeah. So... Essentially, this Wyndham, without much, I guess, warning, started rolling out this new social media campaign, and people reacted with a lot of anger about it, or, you know, certain segments of the skiing population. On their website, one of the initial things, and it was also on their Instagram and stuff, was an employee kind of taking down the sign for Wyndham. And it said, like, say goodbye to the old Wyndham. And then they introduced this new concept, which was Club Wyndham. They did this without, you know, kind of, like, explaining exactly what it would be. So people's imaginations ran left and right on it. But there are going to be significant changes. You will, starting this winter, be able to purchase a membership to Club Wyndham. It is $175,000. And that doesn't include, you know, annual dues.
Which are undetermined.
Which are undetermined right now. I asked Wyndham, and they said they were still calculating what exactly they would be. But, you know, you get ski passes and priority with certain things. That's not to say that you can't just go to Wyndham in upcoming years and just buy a day pass, except for on Saturdays, because that's one of the large changes, too. Essentially, you know, you can't buy day passes for Saturdays from early January to early March. So they're kind of changing things up. There's this Club Wyndham thing. They're hoping to get a few hundred people to sign up for it. It's, you know, very expensive. I mean, best of luck to Wyndham. And then the changes are affecting kind of like the day pass skiers, because, you know, I talked to them and they said they were trying to encourage people to stay at Wyndham Mountain and in the town of Wyndham, which is, you know, a very nice town, for multiple days, which is why essentially you'd have to get a 2-day pass, a weekend pass, if you wanted to start on Saturday.
So it's really the locals that are getting the shaft here with this, they can't buy a 1-day pass on Saturday.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's what they're arguing.
Because if you're a tourist, you're probably coming for the weekend, and so buying a 2-day pass isn't a big deal.
Yeah, it isn't, but it kind of discourages people that are local or that are just, like, dodging up for the day. Because, you know, people do that from the city if they're, like, really hardcore skiers. But it's kind of putting a damper on that. And the concerns from, like, skiers, both, like, local and, like, people that just hit Wyndham up regularly, is this was like part of them trying to upscale. And this was just like the first step, because with the membership, there's all these amenities that are going to be added on, such as like a private golf course, a private spa that, you know, like the day pass holders wouldn't have access to. But, you know, these amenities haven't been built yet. Initially you're not going to be getting like a huge amount of stuff for the 175K. And B, there was concerns that like this eventually will just become like a private club, because in the rollout of this announcement, they referred to Wyndham Mountain, the Wyndham Mountain Club is a semi-private club, and that just drove people insane.
Because people, especially like people that live in Wyndham, sort of they feel like the mountain is theirs. It's like part of the community.
Yeah, no, there's a lot of ownership there. Wyndham is a small place, the town, and then, you know, the mountain is a huge employer and very much part of their life there. There's also construction that's going to be happening on Wyndham. They're building like condos and single family homes, and their argument, or Wyndham's argument, is that it would employ additional locals, which, you know, like I believe, and is very true.
I don't know. I see these towns, they do FRPs, and then the company that's constructing is from Albany or Ulster County, or, you know.
Well, it's how you define local, yes. I suppose. That's a good argument. And, like, I'm not sure if everyone they need is going to be within the town of Wyndham. I mean, like, that would be ridiculous if everyone they need is in the town of Wyndham. There's only a few thousand people in the town of Wyndham. But, you know, they didn't define what a local job would
be. I'm just saying, if their argument is that this is going to employ local people and help the Wyndham community,
yeah,
it may not really.
Yeah, it may help the broader community.
Hudson Valley community.
Yeah, the Hudson Valley community, but Wyndham itself, you know, I mean, it's not going to be taking all of its employees from Wyndham.
And then are they eliminating mountain biking, or is that just in the winter? Or because they've built all these mountain bike trails over the past 10 years or 15 years.
Yeah, and I'm not an expert on mountain biking, but apparently they're like world-class.
Right, they have world-class competitions there. The folks in Catskill that opened that bike shop, they're former competing, and they ran this international competition like 5 years ago at Wyndham Mountain.
Yeah, no, they're pretty famous. They're getting rid of them completely. Like, next warm season, they will
no in the
there.
Summer.
No time at no point in the year.
So the rich people don't use mountain bikes? Is that what we're hearing? Or
well, the argument that Wyndham made was that it was a very particular outdoor pastime, and that like the average person visiting Wyndham wouldn't want to go on these like difficult mountain biking trails. So what they said is that they were trying to introduce summertime activities that were more like general interest. And one of these was golf. Not exactly as exciting as downhill mountain biking, but you know, more people golf than do the former. And, you know, they are, as like everyone in the Catskills is doing, especially as climate change ramps up, is make it more of a year-round destination. And I think that this was them trying to, broaden the activities and how many people could engage in them in the summer. But a lot of people are very disappointed in that. And even Wyndham said it was like a very tough decision to do that. But yeah, no mountain biking next summer.
It seems crazy. The investment they made over the years in making those trails, and then what, they're just going to let the trees
the woods
grow?
Take over. Yeah, it almost does, because like they're trails and they're already there, so it's not like they're gonna destroy the trails.
I guess there'll be
like
hiking trails probably.
Yeah you know, you could always still hike them. They're not gonna like burn the trails. Like, no one will use them from now.
And I thought Hunter Mountain got similarly bought by an outside company recently, right? The Hunter family finally, or the Slutskys, is that
Slutskys,
what?
Slutskys, yeah.
That owned it, finally sold it like a couple years ago.
Yeah, that happened with Wyndham and Hunter. Wyndham is majority owned by North Castle Partners, but then two other wealthy families invested in it this past year. And then, like, yeah, Hunter is part of the Vail family now, I believe.
So it's related to a bunch of Colorado resorts.
Yeah. I mean, Vail is huge. They control resorts, like, all over the place. But it's this, like, movement within the skiing industry towards consolidation. And I was talking to, you know, kind of an industry expert out west, and they were saying that, yeah, consolidation is a real thing. And what often happens is sometimes the smaller mountains will get shut down, but when they are not, they're kind of upgraded, they're upscaled to get, like, you know, a higher degree, I guess, economically speaking, of clientele. And that seems to be what Wyndham's doing.
And I think, is Bel Air owned by the state?
Yeah, Bel Air is New York State owned.
So that's sort of safe.
They have
from
their own thing.
But they won't get developed into a super high-end thing. That's probably where the public should go if they're getting priced out of Wyndham.
Yeah, Bel Air is more expensive than, I thought it would be. I did an article, like, comparing the various ski mountains a few months back.
Yeah, I assumed it was cheaper because it was a state thing. It's not.
I don't want you to quote me on this, but, like, I expected it to be cheaper than it was. But it's a very nice place. Like, Bel Air is great. But, yeah, they're really protected from industry machinations because, you know, it's a state-owned, it's publicly owned Bel Air.
And then I guess all these resorts definitely want to increase their revenue in the summer because their revenue in the winter may decrease as the temperatures stay warm and the climate alters.
Yeah. I mean, the problem with the Catskill resorts is, you know, they're not in Colorado, they're not in Canada. They're kind of on the line where climate change is going to really affect them, like whether they get snow or not and whether they can make snow. So part of it might be them leaning into that. There's always just everywhere a real push for seasonal, like, resorts to become, like, year-round things because then you can make money year-round, and obviously it just makes more sense in that matter. But, they're definitely attempting that. Like, will there be a situation, like, hopefully this doesn't happen, but if, you know, like, the temperature goes up X amount of degrees and, like, they just can't operate as skiing resorts anymore, like, I don't think they can, like, create enough other activities where they could still be, like, the situation would financially work out for them.
And just to double back to Wyndham before we leave this topic, is there any chance that the criticism or local outrage is going to change anything, or is there a are they listening to comments? Or are they?
They are. The same social media team has been running. It's an in-house social media team has been, like, dealing with all this pushback, and it's been, like, very heated. And
yeah, your story says they are shutting down comments on some posts, and
they
blocked a. There's a parody Wyndham.
It's Wyndham. Wyndham, like, idiocy _MTN. And I talked to the creator of that, who, great person. It was fun. It was a fun conversation.
They stayed anonymous. Do they live in Wyndham?
Well, I wouldn't be able to reveal that. But they had a lot to say. But essentially, like, I talked to Wyndham, and they're like, they absorbed how poorly this rollout was going. So the response was to get rid of a lot of their initial messaging. You can't find it online anymore. But, you know, they also, like, yeah, they deleted comments below Instagram posts, and they blocked the one parody account. I also heard that, you know, people would direct message them with, like, concerns about what was going on, and they were, you know, they didn't have, like, a good bedside manner.
So we'll see if anything changes. I guess probably how well these changes do this winter will, because they're capping the number of actual people on the mountain too, right?
They're capping, but, like, that's less notable because it had been as high as 7,000 before the pandemic. During the pandemic, just because of social distancing, they, like, put it down, and they put it down again to 4,500. they're keeping it at 4,500 because they said the user experience was so much better. But they sliced another 500 off, so the cap's going to be 4,000 this season, which is great for lines, you know.
But maybe not if you arrive at 155 and it's already been capped or something.
No, then you're out on your butt.
Or heading to Hunter or Bel Air.
Yeah, I'm just like, well, they're close enough.
You've been also, besides up on top of the mountains, you've been down in the Hudson River this week.
Yeah. There's a couple things I did in the Hudson River. There was the barges, which is a whole other issue, but essentially...
And the barges is just temporary. They've temporarily stopped it again, right?
They've temporarily stopped it. Like,
for like fourth or fifth time in the past 10 years.
Yeah. it's an issue that keeps on coming up, but it keeps on coming up from different angles. Like, essentially what just happened was this minor rule change that didn't seem like anything at first.
That the Coast Guard made, right?
The Port Authority. Well, no, it was made by the Coast Guard, but it affected the
Port Authority.
Like, the Port Authority and what the New York Port was considered. Because it had, like, the Port of New York had been considered everything from the Statue of Liberty to the to Troy, the Federal Dam in Troy. And therefore, the Port Authority... which is a public-private organization down in the city, had control over where things could moor, where things could anchor. But the Coast Guard redefined this. The Port of New York is just from the Statue of Liberty to the, I'll just say, the Tappan Zee Bridge, because that's what everyone still calls it, slash Mario Cuomo Bridge.
Which, who knows how long the legislature is going to let that stand.
Yeah.
There have been bills already, I think.
It's just, you know, people are just going to call it that for, you know, let's see if it ever takes hold. But at any rate, this kind of left open the possibility of barges being moored north of that. And there was pushback from Congressman Pat Ryan and also environmental groups like Riverkeeper and... The Coast Guard didn't kind of adequately address these concerns, but eventually, I believe on the 7th, they rescinded the rule that would have changed the definitions, but they left it open. They essentially said, like, if we make a change in the future, there will be time for public comment and, like, that kind of thing, which really suggests that, like, yes, they've just pushed the decision off, and, you know, this could well be a battle that needs to be relitigated.
Because it was last year, there were thousands of public comments against this,
it's been going on for a while. Like, the biggest thing was the oil barges, which was, like, a decade ago, when they, like, you know, there was attempts to, like, literally, you know, turn the lower Hudson into, like, a giant parking lot for these crude oil barges. And, like, people had issues with that for so many reasons. It was, like, Bakken crude oil. And, you know, it had to be, like, transferred there, and it was, like, dangerous, and it was an environmental problem, and it was just, like, you know, it would have been a huge eyesore. So, yeah, it's an issue that keeps on cropping up.
And then besides stuff floating on top of the Hudson River, you were also writing about stuff sinking to the bottom of the Hudson River.
Yes, the river bottom. So, essentially, you know, the Hudson River is a Superfund site because of GE's dumping of PCBs into the river from 1947 to 1977. This was when PCBs were still legal. They are not anymore because they are they're very dangerous to human health. There was essentially GE was forced by the EPA to dredge the upper Hudson. That is, like, the Hudson in between... Detroit Federal Dam and Hudson Falls, like North Albany. And they did this to remove the PCBs. But every 5 years, the EPA needs to review how this remediation has, like, worked in the future, or has been working, rather. And essentially, there was the initial dredging, which got rid of, yes, a lot of the PCBs. But then the idea was that the PCB rates would continue to decline at, like, a certain rate. And EPA's own data shows that it's not declining at that rate, and it's actually going up. Yeah, from the last, like, year of available data, which was from 2020 to 2021, like, the amount of PCBs, like, went up in sediment and in fish. So, you know, the EPA released this data publicly, and then Riverkeeper and Scenic Hudson and other organizations took it up and, like, analyzed it and did not come to good conclusions and essentially said that the dredging project was not going to plan, which, you know, the numbers seem to suggest. And they don't have any, like, policy suggestions, but they're just pointing out, like, this raw math that, like, this isn't working as well as the EPA wanted it to.
And the EPA is going to put out their official analyzation of the data next year? Is that
Yeah, early next year. They were unable to be more specific than that, but, you know, like January, February, I assume. And Riverkeeper had presented its findings to the EPA, and this is just through Riverkeeper, but essentially the EPA disagreed with Riverkeeper's conclusions about the program, like, not having worked. They were looking at the same data, but they came to different conclusions. So we got to wait for that EPA report to come out and see what they say about it.
Well, everyone can agree that at least removing the PCBs remove them from the river, right? So
you got to remove some of them.
Some of them, right. You can't get everything. And
yeah,
you probably kicked up some PCBs that flowed downriver in the process.
I mean, arguably. I mean, like, they stopped dredging like 8 years ago at this point, though. So I feel that
the dust may have settled by now.
The dust may have settled, yeah. So, I mean, there's, I have a couple, like, you know, bar napkin theories as to why the PCB levels might have been rising, but I'm not going to speculate right here. But, you know, it clearly it's not what the EPA hoped would happen. And there's a whole issue between New York State and the EPA, which is the, you know, federal government, because the DEC was attempting to get the lower Hudson also dredged. That's our part of the world, south of Albany to the Statue of Liberty. But the EPA did not bite, and there was, you know, a brouhaha for a couple years about whether the lower Hudson should be dredged. The EPA was never amenable to that, so they seem to be on the GE has done everything they can side of things, so who knows how they're going to address these new findings with the numbers.
And I guess we should remind people that all the experts say that you should only eat a fish from the Hudson River once a month or something, and not if you're pregnant?
Yeah, in the lower Hudson, which is south of Albany, is one fish a month, nothing if you're pregnant or breastfeeding. In the upper Hudson, which is north of the Troy Federal Dam, you're not supposed to eat any fish, like, ever, because they'll hurt you with those PCBs.
And the PCBs are, of course, in the class of forever chemicals that take they were used in part because they take so long to degrade, right?
They do. They're not there's a bit of – I received an email, like, taking issue with that, actually. They have a lot of difficulty breaking down in nature. That doesn't mean it's impossible.
It's not as bad as PFOA or...
Yeah, like PFOAs and PFAs, that's where, like, the term originated, forever chemicals. They used it at the presentation of the numbers with Riverkeeper and everything. And although they have, like, a huge amount of difficulty breaking down in nature, like, it is technically possible for them. So just to make a distinction, but
it's one of those terms that's kind of becoming more widely used,
yeah,
and it's not
yeah.
being widely used as the way it was originally.
Yeah. Exactly, exactly. So, I mean, that being said, it's not just, like, you know, a paper cup that'll just rot and dissolve into the surrounding, you know.
You can put a time-lapse camera and watch it.
Yeah, yeah. It's not a rotten apple. Those, you know, the PCBs are going to stick around for decades and decades and a long time.
One other story I wanted to ask you about, because it sort of went under the radar, and the issue kind of went under the radar, that cannabis stores opened in Hudson this week, and, like,
oh, yeah.
Nobody noticed, right?
It was
the world didn't end.
Yeah, no, I thought people would be, like, firing shotguns in the air, but it's because they weren't, like, dispensaries. dispensaries are still opening, like, very slowly, which is why the state allowed these kind of things to open, which
they're temporary pop-up shops.
They're like pop-ups. There's like two ways you can do it. Either like a farm, like a licensed cannabis farm, can set up like something, and some of them have done this at like farmers markets, like in a farmers market in New Paltz. They had one of these. And the second way they do it is an existing licensed dispensary can open like a pop-up. So two pop-ups opened in Hudson. One was from a dispensary in Latham or Colony, around the Albany area. The other one was Manhattan. It's a Gotham dispensary down in Manhattan. And, you know, they're both, I got to walk around the one, the Gotham one. And, you know, it's, like, very nice. And their whole thing is, like, dispensaries still have kind of a furtive kind of gray market feel to them, even though it's 100% legal. So the one in Hudson really throws that by just being this, like, open, like, there's light everywhere and, like, nice wood. And just, like, the products are just out there and people are wandering around shopping. So it's quite nice.
Yeah, it's. I wonder how long it's going to be that you have to show your license like three times, where you go into a liquor store and I don't usually show my license.
Yeah.
You know, there's all these like weird rules that are like put in by the people that think cannabis was like this scary thing, but you know, alcohol is much more problematic for society, right?
Well, police it's hard forces. To argue that. Yeah. No, it's, I mean, they're both drugs and, you know, they both have their downsides, but, you know, no one's going to rehab for marijuana.
Yeah. And there, I mean, and just the people that like were afraid to have it in their town, like it opened in Hudson. Nobody even noticed.
Yeah.
I didn't notice until your story ran. I didn't see like one comment on social media anywhere of like, oh, the cannabis store is in on Hudson, you know, like.
Yeah.
I haven't seen any outrage. I haven't seen any, like, complaints.
No.
I haven't heard any, like, I haven't heard anything about it, really.
No, I expected there to be more of a splash. Like, part of it is that, you know, it's been a few years, and, like, people are like, yeah, marijuana is legal now. And part of it is that, you know, Hudson is a very kind of progressive place and that kind of thing. But, like, it's just, yeah, it's not as big a deal as one would think. They might be getting a marijuana lounge in Catskill, actually.
Yeah, there was a public hearing on Monday,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, there was. I got to check in on that. But, you know, I think it's going to be a similar thing. No one's head is going to blow up because this place might potentially move in.
And on the other hand, all these towns were counting on tax revenue that 2.5 years later they haven't seen a penny of, right?
Yeah. I can't talk very widely about that issue, but that's sticking in the maw of some, yeah.
But I guess Hudson's going to get a little bit at least.
Yeah, and the county's going to get some
months.
Too.
Yeah, right.
so, I mean, you know, that's why it was legalized in the first place. Like Denver legalized it before anyone else. Everyone saw what their revenues were like. And then, you know, that's how you win over the functions of government, by saying, like, there's going to be more revenue and, like, you know, you can't argue with that.
unless you're maybe in the House of Representatives.
Yes.
Who, you know, I'm not sure what the motivation is exactly.
Functions of government. Yeah.
Functions of government. Right. All right. Anything else? Or you want to tell us what what's coming up in the Times Union this week?
Yeah. I'm about to go off. There's a River Access Forum about a mile from here I'm next going to. It's interesting.
About Germantown or
no? It's like about the whole Hudson River Valley and accessing the river. It's a big deal. But you know, long story short, there's been traditional issues with like residents accessing the Hudson River for recreation, and Scenic Hudson has put together this giant like 600-page report about how people traditionally access the river and how. People may more safely do this in the future with the help of like Amtrak and the Department of State and that kind of thing.
And CSX on the other side.
CSX,
I mean, there's a freight
yeah.
train on one side and a passenger train on the other side of the river.
It's like a gauntlet of trains
to get to the water. Yes.
Yeah.
I asked about Germantown because Germantown's had that issue for years with the train access at that park there along the river.
Yeah, there's actually several parks that have that issue. Castleton on Hudson also has that issue in that, this road was closed that gave them access to this park that the town owns, but the at-grade crossing was closed down by CSX and Amtrak, so there's this like park they own that no one can get to. So it's an issue up and down the river, and there's going to be people from like Poughkeepsie and Kingston and Rhinebeck and Germantown and Hudson. It's going to be this big event, so I'm going to be checking that out next.
All right, so we can look forward to that. Anything else you want to tell us about, or?
No, that's it for the moment. But thanks a lot for having me.
All right, we are glad to have you back. We've been talking with Roger Hennigan Gilson. You can read him in the Times Union. The story today is about the PCBs. Today was Wyndham, right?
Today was the Wyndham story. Yeah.
Yeah. The PCB story was yesterday.
That was yesterday.
The Hudson River access will be tomorrow.
Yes.
All right. Well, thank you again for joining us, and we'll talk to you again next week.
Okay. Talk to you next week. Thanks
Here
a lot.
Is a story from our friends at WOOC in Troy.
We're talking with Justin Wood, who is the Director of Policy for the New York Lawyers for the Public Interest. He's also involved, active with New York Renews, which on Wednesday, Broad Coalition held a series of news events across the state to launch their campaign for next year on climate, jobs, and justice package. So, you know, welcome, Justice, and, you know, maybe just give us a brief introduction to New York Renews and why your group's involved.
Absolutely. Thanks, Mark. My name's Justin Wood. I'm the Director of Policy at New York Lawyers for the Public Interest. We're a community lawyering organization based in New York City with a focus on environmental justice, health justice, and disability justice. And for since the inception, we've been involved with New York Renews, a member of this broad and diverse organization, or coalition rather, of 370 plus organizations across New York State in every region of the state. We, along with a lot of other members of this coalition, were involved in shaping and then fighting to win New York's really landmark climate law called the Community Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act in 2019. And since then, we've been really engaged in advocacy to fully implement the law to meet the essential goals of reducing greenhouse gas emissions and local pollution that's harming the health of so many of our communities across the state.
Now, we cover New York Renews quite a bit on the show. A lot of times, Bob Cohen from Citizen Action, and you know, they've been on about talking about the New York Heat Act and the Climate Change Superfund Act and the Just Energy Transition Act. But I also understand, you know, I know in the past New York Renews has talked about a broader $15 billion budget request, but this year they're apparently trying to focus on, you know, $1 billion at least in this budget as a down payment.
Yeah, that's right. What we're really focused on is making the state's climate law a lived reality for New Yorkers starting this year. And so we know the level of investment that our state government needs to have to make sure that we're avoiding the worst outcomes of climate change and making sure we're ready for the unavoidable parts of climate change, like extreme flooding, extreme heat, that we're already experiencing wildfire smoke. I mean, I don't need to tell New Yorkers. These are really troubling things that we know are going to keep happening. But we know that the level that our government needs to invest, and this is according to their own rigorous studies, is at least $10 to $15 billion a year, which is actually a pretty small and reasonable portion of our state's economy. But what we're also focused on is really making it concrete for our legislators and for New Yorkers to understand so that there are projects that we could start today if the governor chooses to fund them, projects we could start next month if the governor chooses to fund them, that would both be addressing the climate crisis in communities across the state, creating jobs, a lot of jobs and good jobs in communities across the state, and actually improving everyday life. So that's everything from better transportation that's affordable and efficient and allows New Yorkers to get to work, whether it's within one city or even between cities, as so many people commute long distances now, or something like bringing renewable energy right to our own communities and making sure that energy is cheaper than what we're paying for now, which in many cases is hurting ratepayers because we're paying for outdated power plants and gas lines that we don't need anymore and that cannot be a part of our future if we're going to address climate change.
Now, for the most part, these are not, new proposals. And, you know, I think there was some level of disappointment among climate activists the last couple of years that while a couple good, really good bills were passed, many other good bills, like the agenda this year, was not. What makes us believe that this is a moment where the legislature finally comes to grip that they need a much more robust agenda on the books than what they've been willing to do the last few years?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, our approach as an organization at New York Lawyers for the Public Interest, and I think the approach of most of the members of New York News is that people want these things. People understand. We don't, you know, people understand that climate crisis is here and is getting worse. I mean, I mentioned just a few of the really unfortunate things that New Yorkers have experienced this year. I mean, we were not prepared for what happened on June 7th when toxic smoke crossed our state and caught us by surprise. We do know that that's likely to happen again. Similarly, we're not surprised anymore when, for example, a large portion of our transit system in New York City and elsewhere shuts down due to extreme flooding and people are having to spend huge amounts of money out of their own pockets to fix their homes, which are flooding routinely now. And I think part of the focus now is people know that the climate crisis is here, but our legislators need to hear that it's unacceptable to keep kicking the can down the road and that we need to pay for this damage somehow at the same time that we need to pay for the investments in the future. So some of the bills that we're prioritizing this year, like the Climate Superfund Act, would do exactly the right thing by starting to put the responsibility on the wealthy corporations that have only become more profitable in the last few years that have caused most of the damage in terms of climate change and that are directly responsible for things like people's homes and transit systems and roads and parks being damaged by flooding on a routine basis now.
All this makes sense, but I also read this morning that governor people testified to the New York State Legislature Financial Committee's this week. And one of the points they made is even though they have over $4 billion deficit, we're not going to raise, taxes on the wealthy, and we're actually not going to cut spending on some of the big programs. Yes, they need to raise more money, but how do you convince, particularly the governor that, she needs to put a lot more money on the table for climate than she's been willing to do so far?
Well, that's been a core part of what our coalition has been fighting for, is to make sure that the polluters that have caused the damage and continue to profit from the status quo, even though we don't need the status quo, and there are a lot of examples we could talk about, but that those corporations that are continuing to make profit on a system that causes so much harm, that they're the ones to pay the fair share to increase the budget that New York State has for these climate investments. So this doesn't need to come from low and middle income New Yorkers who pay utility bills and taxes. They should not continue to bear the brunt of these costs. We really need to pass legislation and make sure that there are proposals in the governor's budget and in the legislature's budget that count or do pass these regulations, making the biggest polluters pay their fair share of the cleanup and of the investments and the transition we need to a renewable economy.
So we've been talking with Justin Wood, New York Lawyers for Public Interest, Director of Public Policy, or Director of Policy. And New York Renews has just released their Climate Jobs and Justice Package. Justin, if people want to find out more about this package, or even if they want to express their opinion, one way or the other to lawmakers, how best can they find this information in the last 45 seconds or so?
Absolutely. Well, the best thing New Yorkers can do is really engage and follow New York Renews, that's NY Renews, on our website or on social media, whether you're on Facebook or Twitter or Instagram. And we routinely, again, have the reach of a statewide coalition. And all of this depends on thousands of New Yorkers joining together and really making sure that lawmakers, regardless of what region they represent or what political party they're in, are really focused on addressing this crisis and on making sure that we don't continue to hit ordinary New Yorkers in the pocketbook to pay for this damage going forward. So we routinely coordinate thousands of New Yorkers who want to join and call us to lawmakers.
We're out of time, unfortunately.
Okay.
This has been Justin Wood, and this has been Mark Dunlay for the Hudson Mohawk magazine.
I'm sitting here wondering if this matchbox will hold my dreams. The redhead in my arms go up in flames, will dissolve mighty regimes with her screams. Or so it seems. She dragged my face from the eye to my lip on the rough side of the striking strip, to the port side of a sinking ship, staring at a compact mirror, the siren calling from another era. While you made faces and then blew kisses, drowned in a pool that hypnotized Narcissus. They say I have a perfect face for radio, and a trumpet for listening, a cheek to turn to you, an eye for glistening. Tear that tear from me, hold it in your memory. Pull away the powder and the pain-painted dream of this and that disgrace. A silver band of marching souls, a button of brass, an epaulet of gold. That Lenten light, that slight fanfare that consoles. That trivial, sniveling rosary, that ring-a-ding rosemary, condemned a man, alas, at last, at Requiem Mass. So much better than I look, like a hero in a book. Now there is too much at stake, but perhaps you mistook my mistake for the tip in the print you dusted for from the hand you forgot to shake. Tumbledown Dick said to King Oliver, I don't shrink down at the thought of you. Give the people back their ringlet prince, just like you ought to do. Journey far from here like Gulliver, to lands at the edge of everywhere that we have still to discover. Where there's the soul of a jackboot in a broken brace, poised above a human face, forever and ever. Just doesn't matter if I should deceive you or if I should flatter. If your bankroll gets thin while some kitty gets fatter, Radio is everything. From the straight to the narrow, to the broadcast from within, radio is everything. Radio is everything.
That does it for the WGXC Morning Show. That was Elvis Costello there. Next, we've got an hour of jazz on the radio for you, and then some world music.